Okay, so if the previous speaker put out a disclaimer that he was talking a little bit off of his area of professional expertise, you ain't seen nothing yet. So I have to admit that the title of my talk, Can We Really Know Anything at All, is a little bit risky, because by the end of it, you may in fact be saying to yourself, you don't know for sure, but it's clear that maybe I don't know anything at all. Nevertheless, I'm going to try to talk a little bit, or I'm going to talk a little bit about how we put together our picture of reality, what the universe, what the world is really like, sensory information, mental processes that we use to assemble some idea of what's going on out there, which I think you'll agree is relevant not only to the conduct of science, but also how we put together a picture of God's interaction with the world and our relationship with God in the supernatural realm. And so this is part of the basis for even caring about this. If our Christian faith is based on verifiable historical evidence, then objective exploration, history a form of science and objective exploration, can lead to truth about the universe. We have some evidence, some reason to believe that God will not deceive us if we are making an objective investigation into what's really going on out there, history, science. But our capabilities to comprehend, apprehend, and understand the universe as it really is are subject to serious constraints. And I'm going to talk about those constraints here today. And hopefully you'll find, maybe learn a little bit, but also find some of this a little bit amusing. So we're going to start talking about sensory limitations. This is an area in which I actually do know a little bit professionally. Or for those of you computer scientists in the room, you know what GIGO is, right? Garbage in, garbage out. If we have sensory limitations and our image, our view of the world, our mental model of the world is built from what we can perceive through our sensory systems, how reliable can that be just to start with, just based on raw data? Okay, so let me start with an obvious one. We all know the electromagnetic spectrum spans a very wide range, and the visual system is able to perceive just a very small part of it. So right there, we have serious limitations on the bandwidth of information that we are able to apprehend directly in the universe. Now, we're going to go through these very quickly. Everybody gets a kick out of visual illusions. Are the dots at the intersections black or white? Well, there are no dots at the intersections. The lines curved or exactly, thank you. Are the lines curved or straight? Well, they're straight. Which circle is larger? Which of the center circles is larger? Obviously, you get the hang of it by now. They're the same size. But this is an interesting one because it tells you that we make differential judgments. We make judgments on things based on the context that they're in. Is there a triangle in here? This is a form of a gestalt illusion. The brain, the visual system, fills in the missing information, the lines on the sides that are missing, and forms a triangle. Very convincing illusion. Not only are there visual illusions, but there are auditory illusions. So I'm going to start this. What I want you to do is close your eyes at first. I'm not going to play a trick on you, I promise. Close your eyes at first and listen to what this woman is saying for a few cycles, and then open your eyes and see if that changes. Okay, did anybody get it? Did anybody get the, okay. So those of you who really experienced it, she was saying the same thing the whole time. She didn't change when you opened your eyes. She doesn't know when you opened your eyes. This is an example of binding of visual and auditory information. Not only can you not trust what you see, in cases like this, you can't even trust what you hear, because what you're hearing was very heavily influenced by the shape of her mouth and lips as she was forming the words. Okay, now let's get to something that I think is very interesting, and this really is from my direct professional experience. Not only do we have visual illusions, optical illusions, auditory illusions. There are other types of sensory illusions that you probably are not so aware of, but some of us make a career out of studying. And so, again, let me put this into perspective. I'm just giving you some fun examples of how it is that our sensory systems, our perceptions, can fool us in various ways, even subtle ways. Okay, so this is an example from the vestibular system, my favorite sensory system. Vestibular system, the sensory organs that give you equilibrium and balance, the non-auditory part of the inner ear. Your inner ear has, the vestibular system has angular sensors to tell you when you're rotating the head, and linear acceleration sensors, literally little linear accelerometers on each side of the head in the vestibular system. Linear accelerometers, you may remember from Einstein's equivalence principle, no single physical device can distinguish between linear acceleration and gravity. So these linear accelerometers can get fooled when they're called upon to make distinctions between linear acceleration and gravity. This is the kind of thing that screws up astronauts when they go into space, because now there is no net gravitational vector. It's offset by the orbital velocity. And there's a problem with this part of the vestibular system in interpreting motions correctly, linear motions. Okay. So if you have a linear accelerometer, and let's say that it's sitting right here, and you accelerate it forward, that will transduce that forward acceleration. If you also take that same thing and tilt it backwards, it will indicate the same thing. The magnitudes will be different, but that single device will not be able to distinguish between that acceleration and a backward tilt. So what's the big deal? How can you use this to your advantage or disadvantage? Well, let's say that actually you may have perceived this. It's a little bit subtle, but if you're on an airplane that is starting its takeoff roll, a smaller plane is usually better because you can get a little bit higher acceleration on the order of maybe a third or a half a G. It's doing its takeoff roll and accelerating down the runway, the nose hasn't come up yet, and you may perceive that airplane has pitched up a little bit. That's exactly the thing that I'm talking about here. Okay, so what's the big deal? Well, let's say that you're not in a civilian plane. Let's say that you're in a military jet and it's taking off with a catapult launch from an aircraft carrier. So you go from zero to a couple hundred miles per hour in about a second or two. That's a pretty high acceleration, right? And what will happen, it's what I've depicted here, the actual motion is pretty much straight ahead. The sensation that the pilot will get from this vestibular illusion is pitching up, right? Because that's the same as tilting the accelerometer back, the vestibular system. And what will happen if they're not highly trained? Well, they will correct for that illusory pitch up, and they will fly into the water right off the bow of the aircraft carrier. And this has actually happened. So this is why, for example, the Air Force and the Navy are interested in this type of thing. So that's an illusion of linear motion from the, say, imperfections of the vestibular sensors. There are also illusions of angular motion. So if I bring you into our laboratory at Johns Hopkins and put you on a rotating chair and mask the noise and blindfold you so that you don't have any other sensory cues, and I put you on a chair and spin you around, constant velocity. So you're spinning, 10, 20 seconds, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. After about 2 minutes, you lose the sense that you're rotating. The vestibular, those angular rotation sensors of the vestibular system are tuned to detect changes in angular motion. So they get fooled with repeated, continuous angular motion. And that sensation, and we can stick electrodes in various parts of the brain downstream and find that information disappears, right? So you don't know that you're rotating anymore. Now, if you go to move your head or get up from the chair while it's rotating, you realize very quickly because you've got other sensory information coming in. Okay, so this is usually just a clever little trick. We have fun with this kind of thing in the laboratory. But this can be really bad news. That's on the lower right there. Let's say that you're piloting a small plane. You get into a cloud bank. Your visual reference of the horizon is completely obliterated. And you start a nice, wide, sweeping turn. And that turn lasts for 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 40 seconds. After a while, the vestibular system tells you you're not turning anymore. As far as you know, you may have reached straight and level flight, but you're still turning. When the plane is banked at an angle, the wings don't give you as much lift as you think you're getting, and you can get into something called, colorfully, a graveyard spiral. And this has also happened. Okay. So I wasn't going to show this, but since the video started, this is the converse of the vestibular part. It's also possible to have visual illusions of motion. This is the thing that you get if you're sitting in your car at a stoplight and the car beside you starts to pull out or move backward. You slam on the brakes even though you're not moving. All right? That's because usually things in the peripheral field of view don't start moving uniformly unless you're actually moving through the environment. So it gives you a very compelling sense of what we call advection, visually induced sense of motion. And this is just an example how we can do this in the laboratory. Put you on our famous rotating chair, have a large drum around you, and the drum spins. You can move it back and forth. Typically, we'll have it go at a constant velocity, and it is really convincing. You are sitting perfectly still, and you feel like you're going in the other direction. So, visual illusion of motion. Okay, let's see. I think I'm going to skip some of these things. Oh, there is one famous one. I don't have the video for this one, but if I say people bouncing basketballs with a gorilla walking through them. Do you know the video that I'm talking about? Very famous one with a bunch of people, and you tell people in the audience, count the number of people playing basketball or the number of bounces or whatever it is, and somebody dressed in a gorilla suit winds his or her way through the people, and then you stop the video and say, how many people saw the gorilla? And people are like, what gorilla? So, you know, you're not a blank slate, and this is what I'm going to get to. You're processing things based on what you're expecting to see. And we're filtering information all of the time, sometimes passively through the imperfections of the sensory systems, sometimes actively by what we're expecting to see. So let me draw an analogy to this. One of my favorite books called Flatland describes a race of people who live in a two-dimensional world. And it's a very interesting, lighthearted story, but goes on to make the point that, for example, if the universe really is three-dimensional, but you live on a two-dimensional surface, you see things in a distorted manner. So, for example, this sphere that exists in a three-dimensional world, you can only perceive as a circle, or if it just touches your universe, your world, as a point. So you can't perceive the full richness of this thing that exists in a dimension higher than the dimension that you're stuck in. And this is kind of an analogy that I use sometimes when I think about the fact that we're really limited in our ability to perceive what's really going on out there because of imperfections in our perceptions. So, as if that's not bad enough, that's the garbage in. But we have ways of dealing with that. Scientists make instruments of various kinds. They extend our perceptual range so that we can get past this and do a little better job at figuring out the physical processes going on. Nevertheless, there are problems inside. We're not blank slates, right? We process information based on what we expect to see. Preconceptions. So, stairs. This is to remind me to tell you of a story. In our laboratory at Johns Hopkins, it's kind of at the corner of the building, and there's a stairway here, and then about 100 feet down the hallway, there's another stairway. And if I'm feeling in a particularly good mood, I will actually take the stairs rather than the elevator. It's only one floor up. Okay, so I have taken both sets of stairs hundreds of times because I've been there 15 years. And one day, I was taking one of these sets of stairs and bounding up the stairs, and I came out into the second floor, ready to go, ready to make the turn, go down to the lab and get some work done. And I stopped cold because I had absolutely no idea where I was. Why? Because I was in this stairway, and I thought I was in this stairway. Now, big deal. I've seen that same visual world hundreds of times. I should have been able to do it. But the expectation of what I was going to see, I had an internal model built up for the visual world from one stairway. I was in the wrong stairway. And literally, I had to stop and think about it. Okay. This is interesting, again, professionally for me, not because of those stairways, but we think this is one of the mechanisms leading to motion sickness, sensory mismatch, a mismatch between what we're expecting from various sensory inputs and what we actually get. The Earth overhead, let me tell you that story. This is not from direct experience, but there is a somewhat famous anecdotal report of an astronaut early on in the space shuttle program in the behind the cockpit, the workspace on the upper level of the shuttle, and there's an overhead window. And when the astronauts train in the on Earth, they're, of course, always training with a very strong 1G vector, and that's where the floor always is, and that's the way gravity is pointing. And they get very used to that, and they have a lot of visual vertical cues, and everything is great. And when they go into space, the gravitational part is taken away. And if you're not feeling too good for the first couple of days in space, you like to get yourself in a orientation that you're comfortable with in space. So they will situate themselves, even there's no physical need to do that, they'll situate themselves in a way that they're vertical with respect to the vertical things that they're used to on the shuttle. And this guy was working away and then looked up over the window, and there's the Earth. Yeah, so you know what happened. It vomited immediately. Well, sorry, that's a big news in our business when we study this sort of thing. Because, of course, the Earth belongs down there, and that person had this mental image, this very strong internal model put together. Okay, I'm not going to talk about cicada adaptation. That's something, let's just say there are areas of neuroscience and motor control in which this idea can be tested very specifically. The fact that the brain makes movements, makes decisions based not just on what it experiences, but the difference between what it experiences and what it expects to experience. Okay. Now, I couldn't do justice to Gödel's theorem if I had another 3 hours, but let me just try to give you the idea of this. This is one of my favorite things. Take you back to the beginning of the last century, 1900, David Hilbert, famous mathematician, laid out a series of 23 famous problems in mathematics. The second of those was a finitistic proof of the consistency of the axioms of arithmetic. In other words, if you have the axioms of basic mathematics, arithmetic, can you prove that they are consistent? That is, that they do not prove something that's not true. And specifically, can they prove a statement and its converse? Now, this might sound trivial, but when you start working from axioms in a purely logical system, a purely formalistic system, basically think of a computer algorithm, is it able to go through and verify that you can never prove a falsehood? This turns out to be an incredibly difficult problem. And this led Russell and Whitehead to come up with this massive volume called Principia Mathematica. See, it's published in three separate volumes, where they attempted to do exactly this, describe a set of axioms and inference rules, rules of logic, from which all mathematical proofs could in principle be proven. And just to show you the rigor of this, it was page 378 by the time they got around to proving 1 plus 1 equals 2. So this is, I'm not kidding about that, this is really basic, low-level, rigorous, logical stuff that should be irrefutable. Until this guy, Kurt Gödel, came along. There he is on the right walking with his friend Einstein. And he proved, going to cut to the chase here and make vastly oversimplify this, he proved basically any logical system that's powerful enough to refer to itself cannot be both consistent and complete. In other words, if it's consistent, so that you can't prove any untrue statements, then it's incomplete in the sense that there are statements in that system that can't be proved true or false. Yeah, it blows your mind. It's a very famous paper. There's the title of it, On Formally Undecidable Propositions in Principia Mathematica and Related Systems, Part 1. I don't believe there ever was a Part 2. Here's the flavor of that statement, but in his case, expressed in very rigorous logical terms. the famous liar paradox, right? This statement is false. If it's false, it's true. If it's true, it's false. It's an undecidable statement. There's a way to, in a mathematical and logical rigorous system, to create basically the analogous statement. It refers to itself, and in doing so, says this statement is unprovable. And there you get into a logical contradiction. It's all based on self-reference. The system, the logical system, has to be powerful enough to refer to itself. There's a clever little example of self-reference here. Hofstadter's law, it always takes longer than you expect, even when you take into account Hofstadter's law. Okay, so let me jump ahead a little bit. Okay, so what is the point of all this? Well, science prides itself, with some justification, on being an objective search for the truth and laying out objective reality. However, scientists are by no means, at least successful ones, dispassionate observers. They try to be objective. We try to be objective. There's this very interesting book that I just read, The Everyday Practice of Science, where intuition and passion meet objectivity and logic. It makes a very good point that if you're going to promote a scientific hypothesis, you have to take an advocacy position on that. You've got to believe that that's true, or else you don't have the energy to push it forward. So the idea that scientists are just completely passive, objective observers taking things in, that's not true. Any honest scientist would say that. So may call this maybe perhaps a religion of science, a faith in the scientific method, a faith that the universe is at some point understandable, that the scientific effort is worth doing, but also, at least temporarily, faith in your hypothesis. The reason that science does work and does succeed and is able to make predictions and correct interpretations is the idea of falsifiability has really laid out and described by Karl Popper, famous philosopher of science, that to be legitimate, a hypothesis, a scientific hypothesis, has to be falsifiable. Right? You got to let yourself open to contradiction. Okay. So the bottom line from all of this, is it just futility? Should we give up? Is it not worth trying to understand the world, either the natural world or, let's say, the supernatural world, a place where our faith comes in? Well, I don't think so. I think you're practicing science. I can't think so. I have to believe that there's some method to this madness. So the scientific method is a systematic method to deal with these limitations I just described, falsifiability of hypotheses. Also, it really works pretty well. There is, the thing I skipped here was this famous excerpts from this very famous essay by the physicist Wigner on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences, and this is really well worth reading, points out that mathematics and by corollary, the physical sciences are amazingly powerful, and one of the ways that they do that through mathematicization of physical principles is by making predictions of new things. And that's how you have some confidence that you really are explaining something about the world and not just epiphenomena. So we can make successful predictions through science, but of course there are limits to the inductive approach. All science is basically inductive. So any really honest scientist who's really thought about the methodology and thought about the limitations of their thought processes and the data they come in will have to tell you that you never know. It's the black swan problem, right? Nobody ever thought there was such a thing as a black swan until somebody found a black swan. So induction can fail in some cases. Very bottom line here. Is there an analogous position for religion? So you might say that scientists should maybe show a little bit more humility, given all of these imperfections in sensory systems, in logical systems, in our thought process that we're subject to these imperfections. Scientific objectivity is a great thing. It's made a lot of progress, but you got to be humble about the approach and realize that there are imperfections. Should there, though, be a similar type of position for religion? Should there be something, what I might want to call the science of religion, that religious views, your religious perception or mental model of the world, how God interacts with the world, how you relate to God, should they be put to some of the same types of, through some of the same types of processes as a scientific process? Should you propose, for example, religious hypotheses that are falsifiable, to think, I think this is how God works in my life, maybe I should test that, but I have to be willing to change my mind. And so something I may call the science of religion. And I think that is where I'm going to stop, except I'll give a plug to these two great books that describe in more detail some of the things that I've been talking about. And thank you. Probably because I was equally vague in presenting it. It's hard to give examples because they tend to be very personal. But for example, so I get into dangerous territory here, maybe. But you. Well, of course. That's right. People are very willing, when things go right, for example, to say, that was God granting me whatever it was. But when that thing goes wrong, or perhaps goes wrong for somebody else, there's a tendency to compartmentalize the thing. Oh, God made it work correctly, but isn't there a corollary to that? Isn't there, if you want to be intellectually honest about that, lay it out in hypothesis form and think it through. Does that mean when that thing, maybe that same event, or you're depending on God's grace for it, maybe you're late for the airplane and you just make it just in time, and you say, through God's grace. All right, well, what about next week if you are actually late for the airplane and you miss it? Then do you just say, well, God gave up on me there for some, or some, you know, I'm just saying, show some intellectual honesty if you want to propose that God is working in the world. Be consistent about it, or just say it's random. But that's a different hypothesis. Then you can just say, well, yeah, God does interact with the world, but on a random basis. But try to be, you know, think it through and be consistent.
Would you say that the attempts to test the efficacy of prayer that they go on for some years would fit your model?
Yes, very much so. Right. Now, it turns out there are, the ones I know about, there are methodological issues with a lot of those tests of prayer.
It strikes me that there's a variable there that's hard to control.
Absolutely. Exactly. That's right, which is, yeah, exactly right. Well, of course, the whole conversation, the whole thing presupposes the fact that God will be consistent. And, of course, that's a hypothesis there, too.
You have to know what consistency for God is.
That's right. That's right.
Good idea, though. Well, any other questions before we quit? Thank you very much.